performances and ceremony. A celebration of the United Kingdom, directed by Danny Boyle.
We hope for future generations to look back and know that in the summer of 2012 we were here and that we did them an honour.
Join us for what promises to be a remarkable evening. The opening ceremony, Friday night at 9, live on BBC One and Radio 5 Live.
And now, a little bit of late-night jazz and poetry with highlights from last Saturday night's Proms Plus Late. There for Radio 3 was Tom Service.
This is a Proms Plus Late at the Elgar Room here at the Royal Albert Hall. Now, we've got a fantastic lineup for you for the next 45 minutes or so. You're going to hear two sets from the Rob Brockway Trio and from Adam O'Riordan, a poet. Now, I'm delighted to introduce the Rob Brockway Trio, who are Rob Brockway on piano, Andrew Robb on bass, and David Ingemels on drums. They're going to be playing sets of Rob's music. They met at the Guildhall, and looking forward hugely to hearing what they're going to do for us all here. But we're first going to hear the words of Adam O'Riordan. Now, Adam was the youngest poet in residence at the Wordsworth Trust, the Centre for British Romanticism, and his first collection, In the Flesh, has been published by Chatto and Windus, and it won a Somerset Maugham Award in 2011. So, ladies and gentlemen, to start us off this evening at this Proms Plus Late, Adam O'Riordan.
Manchester, queen of the cotton cities, nightly I piece you back into existence. The frayed bridal train your chimneys lay, and the warped applause track of Victorian rain. You're the blackened lung whose depths I plumb, vermilion windows and the smoke-occluded sun. A girl steps from a door and her cotton-flecked shawl is the first snow on a turf plot back in Mayo. You're the globing of the world, a litany of cities cast and remade in your image. Osaka, Orizaba, Grabovo, your warehouses bloated by curious needs, butter, shellfish, clog blocks, bleach. Your urchins, little merchants, hawking lucifers and besoms to set a small flame guttering in a wet brick basement. In straw and wood shavings, a mother's lullabies bear their freight of love and typhus. In the small hours, I remake you and remake you, until you grow faint as a footfall on a fever ward, and I wake from my imagination's gaslit parlor. Whatever I seek to have, or hold, or harbor, is pure curio, a wreath of feathers, seashells, or human hair, a taxidermist's diorama. Thank you. Silver Lake. This life isn't all hookers and blow, you know. But even so, one day a month you'd ease the car off the boulevard. Your U-turn describing a long, slow arc. Forgetting the pretense of work, the litter of scripts on your passenger seat. Driving south against the rush hour, the commute, as a salmon might make its way by force of will upstream. And so you headed out towards Tijuana. I remember you saying you could order from a menu, how the oiled girls lined up to meet and greet you. But I could not tell you which part of yourself you handed over as your Buick crawled across the border, or which part of yourself you left forever with Tanya, Tracy May, Encarnacion, or Estella. Thank you.
Music by the Rob Brockway Trio, Rob Brockway Piano, Andrew Robb Bass and David Ingemels Drums, ending that Proms Plus Late event, recorded last Saturday at the Royal Albert Hall. Interspersed with jazz, you heard Adam O'Riordan reading his own poetry. It was introduced by Tom Service.
The 2012 BBC Proms. On Radio 3, the BBC Proms cycle of Beethoven symphonies reaches its climax. As all eyes turn to London for the opening of the 2012 Olympic Games, Daniel Barenboim conducts the Ninth Symphony, a vision of hope, reconciliation and hard-won triumph. The last of nine symphonies that changed music forever. Beethoven's Ninth, conducted by Barenboim at the BBC Proms. Friday night at 6:30 on Radio 3.
And now the essay. This week's series, The Father Instinct, looks at the connections between fatherhood and creativity. Tonight, Gulf War artist John Keane reveals how his children have changed his perception of his work as a painter.
There is no more sombre enemy of good art than the pram in the hallway. I googled this old chestnut and it came up with 94,800 results, a figure which suggests that this assertion carries a huge resonance, even if it doesn't mean that it is necessarily true. Not having a mental picture of Cyril Connolly, to whom this quote is attributed, I was amused to note that when I googled his image, he himself resembled nothing so much as a large, chubby baby. I also noted that he didn't have any children himself until he was well into his 50s, after he had married for the third time. Well, I at least have beaten that. I had the first of my own two children at the tender age of 42, which now, even as I write that number, reminds me that it's the number that Douglas Adams unhelpfully decided represented the ultimate answer to life, the universe and everything, according to The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Well, maybe Adams had hit on something there that does retrospectively have a meaning in my own life. I never wanted to have children, or it might be more accurate to say, I paid lip service to the idea that at some point in my life I might find myself having become a father, but not yet. The moment was never quite right. It certainly felt true that the idea of family life did not suggest an easy accommodation with the creative process. And my occasional forays into the danger zones of the world, like when I was commissioned as the official war artist for the first Gulf War, would not appear to sit comfortably with paternal domesticity. For whatever reason, I had never settled down into a suitable relationship in which I could envisage this happening, but it was also much to do with the fact that the whole idea terrified me. I did indeed see the prospect of fatherhood as the enemy of art, the enemy of independence. Of my friends who started having babies in their 20s and onward, my observations of how it altered their lives in no way recommended itself to me. My attitude was rather more accurately encapsulated in the 1970s David Lynch film Eraserhead, which, in a subconsciously surreal way, seemed to reflect my own fearful apprehensions about the prospect of babies and fatherhood. The powerfully irrational and dreamlike atmosphere evoked by Lynch somehow distilled my own sense of dread and fear when I watched the film during my wife's pregnancy. The leading character, Henry, who inhabits this throbbing, monochrome, industrial landscape, finds himself left almost by chance in a single-room apartment, abandoned by the former girlfriend whom he was obliged to marry, and in sole charge of a hideously deformed, bandaged, fetus-like creature that she has recently given birth to. The limbless, swaddled creature has a head shaped like a mango, with animal-like eyes on either side, and a mouth that emits a disturbing cackle. It will not eat, becomes ill, and screams inhumanly until Henry cuts open its swaddling bandages to inadvertently reveal its internal organs in a nightmarish scene, mixing the horror of the baby's alien form with acute pathos for what has happened to it, revolting as it is. This film somehow spiritually encapsulated my own very real fears that the child inside my wife's belly might itself fail to engage me in any emotional way and remain instead like a kind of visceral alien. I tried to shrug off such morbid delusions during the time when my wife was expecting, but I could not envisage my life beyond the birth. It was a void beyond a blank wall, completely unknowable, like resetting the clock to zero, and this both scared and depressed me. This state of turmoil was reflected in a self-portrait I did at the time. It was called Time Left, Right Time, Dad's Hat. I had kept an old Trilby hat of my own father's as a memento after he died, and I wore this symbolically for the portrait, despite its being too small for me, to represent my own ill-fitting assumption of the role of father. Whilst I had never been emotionally close to my father as an adult, because his generation and class did not do emotion, he was clearly devoted to us children, and I am sure now that his survival as a Japanese prisoner of war in World War II, which I have only lately come to fully understand, must have intensified our importance to him. The self-portrait, with a hat intended as a slightly comic homage to him, was painted on an old wood panel salvaged from a skip, and I set into it the mechanism of an electric clock, marking the passage of time as the hands circled the hastily daubed marks that denoted a clock face. The hands of the clock counted away the minutes of my old life, the time left before the void that was fatherhood. But perhaps, in the portrait, there was the acceptance also that, finally, at 42, the time was right for whatever lay in store. Hindsight demonstrated that it was indeed right, but that certainly didn't mean that I was ready for it. My epiphany came in the first few months of my daughter's life. I forget exactly when. I was changing an exceptionally smelly and disgusting nappy whose oozing contents had smeared all over the changing pad. As I cleaned up, I realised that this pungent smell that had filled the bathroom was not, in fact, revolting to me at all. Quite the reverse. Its inhalation evoked in me a feeling almost of pleasure. I have never forgotten this moment. Indeed, I can almost evoke the sickly sweet smell, and it emphasises the close link between the sense of smell and the emotions. The emotion, in this case, was love. My emotional landscape had completely changed, and now any story or movie involving bereavement of parent or child that once I would cheerfully have sneered at provokes, no matter how sentimental, a physiological reflex over which I have but limited control. When I find myself lump in throat, barely able to suppress the tears as I watch Jenny Agutter exclaim, "Daddy, my daddy," as her father emerges on the platform through the swirling engine steam at the end of the Railway Children, I know that a razorhead has finally been supplanted. The idea of directly addressing my own children in my work, however, was not something that suggested itself to me for a long time. I had depicted children in paintings occasionally over the years, in work relating to various conflicts that I have addressed, from Central America to the Middle East, but like most of the figures that appeared in those paintings, they were generic rather than specific, and reflected my thoughts about the effects of warfare on the lives of children and the perpetuation of conflict through the generations. I even undertook a project with the charity Christian Aid, looking specifically at the lives of children in post-conflict Angola, a fascinating and rewarding experience. Even though my wife had, over the years, urged me to paint our own children, it was somehow a subject so intimate that I found it too hard, and on the odd rare occasion I tried, it was unsuccessful. It was not until my daughter was 11 and my son 6 that an idea emerged for a painting that blended with the theme of my work at that time and flowed naturally into the series that I was putting together for an exhibition entitled Intelligent Design. The theme of the paintings played with the contrasting belief systems of scientific empiricism and religious faith, and used image and the metaphor of visual perception to reflect upon this conflict of ideas and the very real conflicts that they continue to fuel. Through the subject matter of Charles Darwin, the Iraq War, and religiously justified terrorism, intelligent design culminated in a large painting I called Stardust. During my researches for the paintings, I had become fascinated with the images of the outer reaches of the universe transmitted to us from the orbiting Hubble telescope, now miraculously available for all to see at the click of a mouse. Light that has been travelling for hundreds of thousands of years, condensed through a man-made lens to form images of astounding beauty. The sheer wonder of the vastness of what is out there defies comprehension, but inspires awe, a spiritual, if not religious, awe, and we are able to observe it and speculate upon it in a manner unavailable to previous generations. And what we see there, digitally enhanced, beautifully coloured, and in high resolution, is what we are, stardust, coalesced somehow into an intelligent life form and circumscribed by love and cruelty. Against this, I had also a photograph of my two children, holding hands, standing on a Suffolk beach in front of the ocean and gazing out to the horizon, their backs toward me. The idea occurred to me of substituting the object of their gaze, the chilly greys of the North Sea, for the richly enhanced hues of outer space and the Dumbbell Nebula, and this charged the image with a resonance invoking both the micro and macrocosmic. But more than anything else, it just reminded me of that old logo from my childhood of Startright shoes, and this resonance was perfect. My daughter in her woolly hat and orange jumper, by chance bearing an uncanny resemblance to the little Startright girl, holding the hand of her smaller brother as they embark upon life's metaphorical journey, the only limit being the edge of the cosmos. This juxtaposition also had unintended but welcome echoes of Caspar David Friedrich's iconic painting, The Wanderer Above the Sea of Mists, which depicts the back of a lone traveller gazing out toward a romantic mountainous landscape. Stardust is shamelessly sentimental, but I hope that the sentimentality is not just toward my own children, but about life itself, its beginning, its end, its continuity, and its infinite potential. It alludes both to the scientific and the spiritual, the personal and the universal. It has been my personal experience of fatherhood, that instinct that had laid dormant for 42 years, with all its attendant joys and irritations, that I now have to thank for a deeper understanding when encountering such works as these, and in trying to sort out what's important from what's not. It's my contention that all good art is, in a sense, drawing. By that I mean that it is a representation of reality that can be recognised and felt by the person experiencing the work. This doesn't mean that it has to be figurative. It can be in paint on canvas, but it could equally well be words on a page, images on a screen, or choreography on a stage. The medium, apart from personal preference, is irrelevant. The recognition in the viewer of something that says, "This is what it's like to be human," is what makes the work, well, work. The painter John Singer Sargent never had any children, but his extraordinary portrait of the daughters of Edward Darley Boyd, painted when he was only in his mid-twenties, is an atmospheric meditation on the process of growing up, which seems absolutely paternal. Haunting and melancholic, unusually and boldly composed with its inspiration in the famous Las Meninas by Velasquez, it shows four sisters aged from 4 to 14 occupying the hallway of a Paris apartment in the 1880s. The youngest sits on the floor playing with a doll. To her left, the 8-year-old looks at us coyly with her hands behind her back, whilst the older girls recede into the shadows, all of them dwarfed by two giant Chinese vases, reminding us how very small they still are in an Alice in Wonderland world of grown-ups. The eldest faces away from us like a disdainful teenager, disappearing into the shadows and powerfully suggesting the uncertainties faced on the brink of adulthood. As my own children grow and assume their own separate identities, that image speaks eloquently to me, now more than ever, of the inevitable distancing of child from parent as the years advance, reminding me that even as my own powers will wane, theirs will grow. But such is the order of things, and it makes me glad.
The painter John Keane. On Friday at the same time, Booker-nominated author Abdulrazak Gurnah describes an emotional reunion with his elderly father. It was first broadcast in April last year and is a Lou Stein Associates production for BBC Radio 3. This is BBC Radio 3, now Late Junction with Fiona Talkington.
You're just a young girl and you should be stepping out. Time to worry about the little things you made. Your man at home left home and left you all alone. And now the world leaves you behind with the baby. Too much fun in town and the baby's got you down. You ran around, now your baby's in the ground. It's time to settle down. Your days of fun you sold away in just one night. You're 22, she already walks and talks. But you're so full of life, you know it isn't right. Too much fun in town and the baby's got you down. You ran around, now your baby's in the ground. Night with mischief on your mind. Nobody knows, so nobody ever asks. Where is your little girl, the life you left behind? Too much fun in town and the baby's got you down. You ran around, now your baby's in the ground.
That's quite a dark song. A Virginian band, The Hot Seats, known for their irreverent humour. And that's from their album Feel. Hello and welcome again to Late Junction. Fiona Talkington with you until 12:30. This is an English duo who call themselves A Band of Berriers. James P. Honey, who's the singer and poet, and Jamie Remain, who's a classically trained cellist. And their album Filth is due out next week. For those with an ear to the ground, the rumblings about have been audible. For first came the bidding war, eventually won in rumours, rare these days, mortifyingly large, and at the end of a raw knack for spotting rough diamonds, buffing them into glowing murder on borders in sealed Victorian letters. Word was that modern day in a basement fathered sensationalism. Halfway grief of thinking, thinking is the link between reports. A worldwide eyed sees the only member of a brood to follow and not look back on any, knowing nothing of farcical fantasies bringing existence. Frame design and tales of prurient salvation, filtering when you flush queasiness could be justified at its crucible celebration to conjure up problems to question tormentor. Strange for all that being, you'll ever only have storyless deliberately because average chop up love in a response of humdrum beauty. Reminded only as a mother applauded loud and lengthy. The feather of fame, a debate for starry grin. You want it to matter.
we'll get wrong. Love's a game fought with white flags and daggers, blunted by the dust that dances on your windowsills just before you wake up. And come the dying of the sun, we bathe beneath faint copper halos and smoke of how some things twist undone.
My heart dry up. From now on, promise you.